We have a musical chair reserved for busy people so we can catch up on their lives. And instead of music stopping when they sit down, we ask them to bring some in. Our guest today is one of New Zealand's very best exponents of humour. Paul Ego, good morning.
Good morning. Lovely to see you.
What is humour? No, I'm just...
Oh, God, it's one of those. How long have we got? What isn't humour? Everything is... If you can't see the humour in basically everything, I think you might as well check out now.
You're a marvellous candidate for the musical chair, I'm assuming, because I'm assuming you're really busy. You're busy a lot of the time. Would that be fair?
Oh, busy enough. I think the comedian's life that I have at the moment is very much feast or famine. So long periods of inaction when I think, boy, I really should. I haven't done anything for a couple of weeks, but then I'll be away for, you know, a big stretch of time as well. So, yeah, it's good. It's good. It's busy enough for what I like.
I imagine you are in high demand because people talk about you a lot, and that's always a criterion. You were Paul Jones once upon a time, I think.
Yes, well, still am. Still am to my family, although my youngest son does call me Paul Ego sometimes, which feels weird. He'll say Paul Ego, and I'll turn around and go, oh, it's not somebody who wants a selfie. It's actually my own child.
If somebody says Paul Ego in your circle, do you kind of switch automatically into Paul Ego mode? I mean, is there a difference?
Oh, a little bit. I think there's an intrinsic kind of sense of performance whenever I'm in any social situation, because Paul Jones actually finds those experiences quite weird. I'm not a big fan of crowds, and kind of I don't really like going out and socialising that much. So when I'm in, I think that's mainly because when I'm working, whether it be a corporate gig or a live stand-up gig or doing 7 days, you're around a lot of people all the time. So you sort of switch into this upper kind of gear of performance kind of me. So when I'm not in that performance me, it is very much two sides.
So you're an introvert in the sense that you need to recharge away from the crowd.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I definitely do. Yeah, I like those, like we're in here, the studio's lovely and quiet. If I had a gig out there now, it'd be perfect. I wouldn't want to really be sort of with the, I like that separation of, okay, you've got to get into kind of performance mode, you've got to get into sort of, you know, here we go. Like, yes. If I was like that all the time, it'd be very annoying for everyone I know. And conversely, the other way, probably, it'd be quite boring.
You're very calm. One thing, because I talk occasionally to people who've seen you MC corporate events, which mm-hmm. you do a lot, and I'll ask you what your last year's return on that was before tax later on. You're very calm, aren't you? And I guess when you do those big shows, you're halfway between Paul Jones and Paul Ego in a way, because you've got to tell them where the toilets are and things.
Yes, a little bit. There is a little bit of that. I do love doing the corporate stuff, to be honest, because quite often a lot of the content is very dry. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you have to say. It's just, you know, where the toilets are and what time dinner's arriving and what the aperitifs are. And so to actually have that kind of quite dry content to work with actually works really well for me, because I can kind of fire off that and turn it into something stupid and weird rather than try and write something specifically for their kind of demo. So the best thing I find when I'm doing that, if they give me a massive document of here's the whole script for the evening and all the awards and all these, there's the guy who won best, you know, fine line plastic fabricator between the ages of, for this, that's perfect. I just go, I don't need to write anything. I can just literally read this and I know that something will happen.
I know you're very droll. You're very good at being droll. That's one of your skills. And another one of your major skills is your quickness, as with all great comedians, I suppose.
Oh, thank you.
You are, someone used the phrase about you, comic fit. Mm. You've been comic fit for a long time. Does that mean that it's a bit like being an athlete? You know, you have done it so much and you've done so much training that it's easier.
Yeah, I think for me now it's very much muscle memory too, because I don't gig live as often as I used to. When I was, before 7 days came along and before I got into breakfast radio, which was kind of my job before that, I was sign writing during the day. That's my trade. I was trained as a sign writer out of school and then doing comedy at night. And I would be doing like in the thousands of gigs a year, if you like. There was one year I did, I think, 1,100 gigs, which compared to some of the comics now who are gigging is possibly around the same level, not really, you know, that much more. But now I would do maybe 20 or 30 gigs, I suppose, a year. But I think that early thing of doing all those gigs, all that stage time, and also being on radio, as you would well know, you kind of, your brain just gets kind of tuned to using content quickly and turning it around. You know, when they go, okay, we're back on air in a minute and a half, what have you got? You've just got to come up with something. And so I think my brain got quite tuned to finding stuff really, really quickly, so that now when I do a gig, I can pretty much walk onto stage and kind of just start. So, yeah, I consider myself very lucky to have done that.
I've got a question off the back of that, because when people talk about 7 days, they acknowledge that the mighty trio are what make the show. You and Di Henwood and Jeremy Corbett, you know, you've got that magic operating between the three of you, and it's a real force, a real funny force.
Mm.
Could you put anybody in 7 days, and if they did it long enough, they mightn't anchor the teams as well as the three of, as well as you two do, but would they then start to get funnier and funnier and funnier the more they did it and develop that kind of comic fitness for TV? Or is it in fact ingrained, it's in your genes, not everybody can do it?
I think it's a style of performance and comedy that doesn't suit every comics. There's comics who've been on the show who are brilliant stand-up comics, but the TV thing doesn't really suit them as far as kind of joining the conversation and listening and picking up on what's been happening.
I've seen that happen.
Yeah, and conversely, there are other comics who I would go, okay, I wouldn't kind of, you know, on a list, I wouldn't say, oh boy, they're one of our best comics, but you get them on 7 days and they just absolutely flourish. And I actually think that's possibly true for me, to be honest. I mean, I consider myself a pretty good stand-up comic, but I think it's 7 days is really my style, is where I've kind of flourished, I think, because I work best when I'm working off other people. Like, I don't think I'm a very good starter. I'm not a guy who walk into a room and go, okay, here's an idea, blah, blah, blah. Di's very good at that, and Jeremy's great at that, but what I'm good at is taking what they've said and then building something else and going in another direction. I don't know rugby analogies, I don't watch enough rugby, but I'm the guy who picks up the ball and then runs with it, possibly not in the direction you want it to go. But
you're the guy who gets given the offload and makes the most of it.
I knew there was something about an offload in there.
In terms of 7 days, I'm not going to be dull and try and unlock all its secrets and shine the daylight in on the magic. But there are episodes, and you wonder, for example, when you were abusing rugby league players in Australia and Chopper, I think a couple of years ago, famously walked off the set, mouthing
and
bitter
stood up on
invective.
Top of the ladder and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
And he, for all the world, looked like he was at the end of his tether, and you had just delivered the ultimate insult about Australian sport, and he hated you for it. And I'm wondering, to what extent are episodes like that genuine or in fact?
Oh, that was completely genuine. I was literally like, are we gonna keep this? Is he? And there was a part of, like, I knew he wasn't really serious, but he's so convincing, I kind of went, is he genuinely pissed off? What's happening here? It was amazing. And we certainly did not plan that. You don't, kind of, otherwise we'd need 5 extra cameras, right, at some point. He's going to climb to the top of this ladder in the set. We need a camera on the ground. No, I mean, they are the magic moments. They're the bits that you certainly don't think, oh, I might say this about this store if it came up. I mean, we all come to the table for 7 days with kind of jokes that we've written for ourselves about the news, where you go, I mean, Simon Bridges says the word slushies 5,000 times, you know that's going to be on the show. So you go, okay, well, I'll write some stuff about that. So you all come into the party with something, but most of the show, like at least I'd say 70 to 80% of the show, it's stuff that comes off the back of that and goes off to the side somewhere. And that's, you can't write for that. That just comes down to the dynamic of the people on there, which we're very lucky to have that dynamic.
I know.
I think that's why it's lasted so long.
I think so too, and it's very admirable. Do people know you're the pack and save voice? That's the other ubiquitous aspect of you at the moment.
Yeah, most people do. Most people do. That's been going for about as long as 7 days, actually. I think we're in the 10 years. 10 years for pack and save, and we've just come into 10 years for 7 days. And most people do, and it's been a real gift, to be honest, that stick man stuff. It's great. I bring it into my stand-up comedy, and I've been telling this story recently, which is very true. So my youngest son, Isaac, who's 14, I don't let him watch 7 days because I hear some of the stuff I say on that. I'm not going to let him watch that.
Oh, interesting to hear you say that.
But he'll be telling some of his friends that his dad's Paul Ego, the stick man. Of course, they don't believe him. But because they're boys, they're not, you know, I don't want to say they're thick, but they're pretty thick. And so he will gather a bunch of his mates round, and he'll come up to me, and he'll say, "Dad, can you do the voice for my mates? Can you do the Stickman voice?" And what I'll do is I won't exactly say, "Hi, I'm Stickman," in the voice. I'll say something like, sorry, I'm not allowed to do the voice, guys." I'll do something like that, and they'll go, "Oh, why not?" And it won't register that I'm actually doing the voice. So I love doing that, and they just wander off going, "Oh, well, I guess we'll never hear it."
How did you end up with that voice?
It was based loosely on a silly character I used to do back in early breakfast radio days, and it was just a kind of a muck-around voice that I happened to be doing in the voice booth when I went in for the audition, because when Pack and Save were looking for a new angle for their campaign, they had the Stickman character, and the brief was it was just meant to be not a Kiwi bloke, but just a budget sort of Kiwi, a normal voice. And then so I just read for it normally, and the sort of voice I'm using now, I suppose. And then while I thought the mic was off, I was doing that voice and just mucking around in the booth going, "Ah, I wonder how long this is going to take," and just saying things I was seeing in the booth, they're nice headphones. Just doing that, and the tech guy came back on the mic and he said, "Oh, what's that you're doing?" I went, "Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to. I was just mucking around while you guys were, having a chat." And he went, "Oh, do you want to read one in that voice?" He says, it's not the brief. It's not what they've asked for, but just read one in that silly voice just for fun and we'll just see what you think." So I read one out in that voice, and that's the one that they went for. But sometimes you don't know what you want, you see?
Yeah.
And that's what you get.
It's funny how life works out.
It is.
Now, your song choices. Paul Ego is in the musical chair. New York, New York, Frank Sinatra first.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was a big Frank Sinatra fan off the back of my dad, Peter, being a massive Frank Sinatra fan. My dad passed away coming up 2 years ago, actually, this month, 17th of July. It will be the anniversary of that. And he always loved Frank, and New York, New York was just his song. That was his put on the record, crank up the stereo loud, and he would sing it. And, sometimes he'd be down the RSA. If there was a microphone, he'd get up there and he'd sing along to New York, New York. And so when he passed away for his funeral, we played this as he left the church, as we took his coffin out of the church. So whenever I hear it, it always reminds me of Dad. And, I mean, I love the crooners anyway, but, yeah, so that song's for him.
Start spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York, these vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York, I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York, New York, New York, gonna make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York, New York.
Frank Sinatra, New York, New York. Was your dad a New York, New York kind of guy? I've often thought about that song, and if I can make it here, I'll make it anywhere. And I've always thought, I have a kind of introvert's reaction to that. I think, oh, if I got to New York, I'd just be going, oh, this is too big a town.
Yeah, my wife and I went to New York about 10 years ago, I suppose, and found it quite overwhelming. I think you probably need to go a few times, definitely. And I think when you're from New Zealand and most of the time you can see the sky or you can see a tree or, I mean, here in Auckland where we are, you only have to walk about 10 minutes and you're near the water. But to be in the middle of New York and look up and sometimes not even be able to see sky, you know, just surrounded by steel, it was quite an oppressive kind of feeling. I mean, once you get out towards the kind of, you know, you go south down and where you can see the Statue of Liberty and start going around sort of the edge of the island and stuff, that's really cool. But yeah, it's certainly the lyrics of the song certainly don't express how I felt when I first went there. But I would love to go back for sure.
Well, it'd be fair to say that there's no better feeling than a gig, stand-up gig, that goes really well as you walk off, and possibly there's no worse feeling if you go out there and fail.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think sometimes you're the wrong comedian for the crowd. And, you know, they say you should never blame the crowd, which you shouldn't really. You should really be able to get up there in any kind of situation and go, okay, I know what this requires, right? I'm a professional, blah, blah, blah. But saying that, even with my 25, 26 years of comedy, even with that, sometimes I'll kind of turn up to a gig and I'll see other comics who are going well and I'll see what the room's like and I'll go, this is going to be hard. You know, even this is going to be about a 6 out of 10, I think, for me. And then others I can turn up and go, this is going to go really well.
And you're accurate with your
surmises? Most of the time. Yeah. Like, most of the time you kind of, you're pretty accurate, but sometimes still, I mean, you know, I've been doing it so long, and I think it's one of the reasons I love it. Sometimes there's still surprises where you go, man, I did not see that happening. Like, I did a gig the other night down with Ben Hurley in New Plymouth, in Ashurst, just in New Plymouth. Big local school hall, fundraiser for the local school down there. About 400 people. I think possibly one of the best gigs I've ever done as far as enjoyment for me, and the reaction of the crowd was amazing. And I wouldn't have kind of said, oh, this is going to be my best gig, hall in New Plymouth for a local school. But it was just amazing. The crowd were fantastic. My material was working well. I was sort of in that point where you can kind of, the stuff that I know is sort of happening automatically and coming out of my mouth. And at the same time that's happening, there's another level of my head which is going through compiling all this other stuff, which I'm going to pepper with it at the same. And it just, sometimes you just get those gigs where your brain is just, it's just firing. You just feel indestructible. It's amazing.
That'd be a wonderful feeling.
Oh, it's amazing. And then you'll do another gig, which in theory should be great, 2 days later and go, I have no idea what I'm doing. I should give up.
The mental agility to be able to do what you've just described seems really impressive. Are there nights where comedians simply forget their material halfway through?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And there's been nights where I've come home and actually made notes on my phone or in a book, like, literally, why aren't I funnier? I've actually written that down. I think in the last couple of years, just going, I should be funnier. Why aren't I funnier than I am? Such a weird thing. And then I'll find that note in my phone and go, what did I write that? I'm pretty funny. Who wrote that?
It's interesting to hear you self-disclose that. But it was always ordained, wasn't it, seemingly?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, my folks were really into their comedy. We used to listen to The Goons a lot, and Mum and Dad were mad Peter Sellers fans. And my dad would have, work friends over for dinner, and their family would come over. And instead of putting on a music, like Frank Sinatra, or some music during dinner, he would put on like a Peter Sellers record while we were sitting there eating a meal. And we'd be sitting there absolutely pissing ourselves laughing. And these other people were like, what are we listening to? This is weird. This isn't Neil Diamond.
Speaking of listening to your second musical choice today, and you've introduced me to this one.
Okay, good.
It's fabulous. One Day Like This.
Yeah, Elbow, yeah. This song is from an album called The Seldom Seen Kid, which I would encourage you to buy. In fact, they did a live recording of that album at the Abbey Road Studios, where the Beatles recorded all their stuff, with a full orchestra and a choir, and it's just hairs standing up on whatever limb you've got your hairs on. They're from Northern England, and I just love everything about them. And every time I hear this song, it just, you know, I've seen them three times now, and playing the song, the whole crowd is singing the chorus, and he gets them to break into harmonies, and they're all, and it's just the most amazing live experience I think I've ever had.
It is very melodic. It's a bit like Northern England's version of U2's It's a Beautiful Day in terms of...
A little bit, yeah.
The other thing is, because you are a songwriter, were by trade, there's a marvellous YouTube video of a guy holding a sign in this, which you will have seen.
Yes.
And it just transforms, I'm assuming it's Los Angeles, it just transforms the mundane into joy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a guy like at a traffic lights kind of scenario, isn't it? Almost, yeah. I think. Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. The song has a lot of joy to it, and it's one of the things I love about those is they take the small, tiny, everyday things, I suppose a lot like stand-up comedy, really, in some ways, and turn it into something absolutely magic. The imagery is wonderful.
Elbow, One Day Like This. That's Albo. Hope you enjoyed that if you hadn't heard it before. Probably half the world's heard it before, though. Paul Ego is in the musical chair. You mentioned Ashurst the other night and the good gig. Do the provinces, the audiences in the provinces differ from the audiences in the cities and the corporate audiences? Do any of the cliches hold true that they're, you know, a little bit more right-wing, a little less liberal and so on? What do you find as you go through New Zealand?
I think the audiences now generally right around the country, they're a lot more comedy savvy than they used to be because of shows like 7 Days, and they can see comics and see, and well, not just 7 Days, I mean because of YouTube and all that sort of thing, they can see a lot more comedy than they used to. Yeah, they certainly do differ. Like I would probably do a different gig if I was playing Wellington than if I was playing a rugby club in Glenfield. You know, the Wellington audiences sometimes are sort of still... Can you say that? Whereas most of the rest of New Zealand is like, oh, I think it's okay to say that. We're just having a, you know, within reason. A lot of the international comics kind of, they don't struggle, but they find it interesting that we seem to have two extremes. We're either really polite or we just won't shut up. There's none of that sort of, you know, we hear lots of stories of a lot of the British comedy clubs where they're literally just yelling you off the stage. Like, you've got to kind of get up there and do your 7 minutes and see if you can get out without getting hit with something. We don't really have that so much.
No.
We either have people who kind of will sit there with their arms folded and go, is it okay to laugh? Or people who just sort of talk all the way through it at a low level, you know. And somewhere in the middle is quite, and hopefully there'll be some laughter in there too, but no. Generally, they are awesome. I always look forward to going out of town for a few days.
I think those descriptions are really insightful, actually. 7 Days has given us other shows to a limited extent, like Jono and Ben in recent times, maybe for the younger demographic. But 7 Days has given us confidence in our comedy over the last 10 years.
I'd say so, yeah. I think you're right. People now go, do you know what? We are, you know, just like the All Blacks, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good at what we do.
That's right.
Yeah. Otherwise, I don't think people would be watching. They'd be going, this is crap. Let's turn on some English show.
I know. Like the old days, this is a bit embarrassing. We should leave it to the English.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit.
And the last question, you are now middle-aged, well, a very young middle-aged man.
Oh, thank you.
And the obvious question, and people must ask it of you, how long will it go on for, this kind of life that you're leading?
Yes, look, I don't know. I'm hoping a long time. I still love it. I still love that buzz of getting up on stage and not quite knowing how it's going to go, and then the first few words and then a couple of lines in and you go, you feel like you've got them and you feel indestructible. There's nothing quite like that. So I feel I've got a few years left in the tank and still got a few bills left to pay, so let's hope so.
Long may it last for you.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you in the musical chair, Paul Ego.
Thanks for having me.